Hey there, welcome to Creative Disturbances. This is Richard Wirth. I'm here at the University of Texas at Dallas. I'm here with Peter Wanica. Could you introduce yourself?
So I'm Peter Wanica. I'm a MFA graduate student at the University of Texas at Dallas.
I'm an MA student myself. Peter and I share a common interest in the field of games for change. I'll be pursuing a PhD here in the coming months, and I believe, Peter, you're more of looking into entering the creative space, working and creating these games workshops, correct?
Exactly. I'm looking more into getting involved with nonprofit groups, research groups, specifically for games for change.
Great. So one of the things that we share in this area is that we aim to explore sort of the socio-emotional intelligence issues, things like I pursue empathy, the concept of pro-social behavior. Peter, you're more of the counseling, cathartic expression, things like that. Could you explain?
So one of the main aspects of research that I'm mostly interested in looking at is how could games actually bridge some of the barriers that people might have in talking about some issue. So, for example, a serious topic like end-of-life scenarios, there are different games out there that people can use in order to reduce somebody's desire to talk about this, so make it much more accessible and friendly through the premise of using games for that.
Great. And I think that's something that a lot of, you know, people typically refer to them as serious games, games that have some sort of socio-political agenda to them, kind of fall under the misnomer of being a serious game, as if you can't have fun with the game. But, you know, just before we started recording, we were talking about the concept of the magic circle and how this element of play is sort of inherent to human nature. And so even though you may be exploring a serious topic and trying to break down walls of communication, break into some serious, you know, empathy-related topics. For example, there are certain games like Papo and Yo. Have you played it?
Oh, of course. That was a great
so
game.
So Papo and Yo is one of these games that tackles a serious issue, such as, in this case, an alcoholic father and how a child deals with that sort of upbringing and with a sort of mental escapism that goes on there. And this issue, while very serious and certainly not to be joked about, can still be explored and better understood, sort of a sharing of the human condition through play. And so I think there's this common misconception that play has to be lighthearted, you know? Would you agree?
Definitely. And especially with the topic of serious games, even that lends itself to little different amounts of misnomers. Like, serious games are military games, commercial games, they're training games.
For sure.
That they might not actually have that fun aspect of play to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've definitely had my share. I worked on a research project, you know, military simulation, training people in foreign cultures. And, you know, that while that definitely has a space and it, you know, they're very critical and very helpful games, you know, lots of personal issues can be explored too. And I think that, you know, speaking of simulations, you and I have pretty unique approaches to how we approach the games for change sphere. You know, I think I'm more of a digital person. You're more of an analog. Would that be fair to say?
Oh, exactly.
Yeah. What do you think are some of the affordances that you're given in analog spaces that you don't have or are better than in digital spaces?
One of the unique things I really see about the analog space is the ability for flexibility. So you can give somebody a different system, like a role-playing system, and based on their unique group, based on the unique dynamics between the group, or even the situations you want to display in that group, you can make these changes on the fly and engage in really different role-playing experiences. And it can also work as a much more visceral experience. If you're experiencing, for example, a digital game on racism, that's going to be a lot more different than a analog face-to-face experience with that.
Oh, see, that's not something I had commonly thought of. You know, people tend to think that digital games are better for things like immersion. And you said visceral. I think visceral experiences tend to be more common in 3D immersive environments, but you're absolutely right that there are different types of interaction that happen between analog and digital, and that's one of the affordances I didn't really think of. You know, my sphere is more of the, I guess, the simulationist route. You know, I look at both indie and AAA games from That Dragon Cancer, which is an indie game created to share the experience of what it's like to having a child dying of terminal cancer, and AAA spaces such as The Walking Dead which is really, you know, a survival story where the player is cast as the surrogate father, which is something that we don't really see in AAA games nowadays. And so you can have this wide variety of topics, both from the deeply personal and sort of therapeutic or cathartic experiences to just a simple walk in somebody else's shoes, giving you something to think critically about. So I would say that in the 3D space and in the study of games, you have more of a food for thought sort of system. Whereas I suppose in the analog space, what you're using in the creation of these games and sort of the role-playing aspect like you thought of is using these games as a tool for maybe not teaching, but self-enlightenment. I'm not really sure how to put that.
Well, actually, I really like that you talked on the tool. What I really like actually about analog games is their opportunity to be used as tools in educational environments. So not using just a analog game specifically without context of a greater workshop, a class on the topic, or a different ability to actually talk about this issue. One good example of that would be that I've heard of the game Dog Eat Dog actually being used in a few workshops on racism. Now, the premise of Dog Eat Dog is that it's a role-playing system where you are one person plays a colonial force and the others are the occupied force people there. And the game actually presents a really good opportunity of having people engage in what does it actually feel to be like a occupied group of indigenous people. And that way, that can actually be used as a tool for sparking the conversation on these different aspects of racism and the power dynamics between occupiers and the occupied.
What do you think that games offer that, in terms of structure and rules and feedback systems, what does that offer people in terms of this kind of education, you know, racism, family dynamics, whatever sort of topic you're exploring? Why make a game out of it? Yeah, I'd like to hear our differing opinions on that.
One of the really great things I think about it is offering people a safe space to actually explore these different possibilities, like how you mentioned the Walking Dead series or even that Dragon Cancer, if I'm correct.
Yeah.
Those offer different spaces of actually exploring the range of human emotions and possibilities for empathy. One of the things that I really study are the different social systems that we might not exactly talk about in a ready field. Like, we might not feel very comfortable talking about racism or prejudice or these different complex social systems, but games offer a really safe place where people can experiment with these different topics and develop a greater understanding about what's going on within these systems and how can we actually spark some conversation amongst these systems.
I really like how you use the word safe place in terms of gaming. I had thought about it in similar terms in that, you know, maybe functionally, games serve the same purpose as, say, a teaching scenario or a counseling scenario, but they offer different environmental affordances. So I read a paper not too long ago that essentially research found that educational games did not differ in results from conventional teaching methods, but they did differ in engagement and motivation for those teaching methods. So I think you're really onto something there when you talk about how, you know, maybe what we need to look at is that games serve as a better space for this kind of exploration, not simply a better tool than. I don't think anybody's suggesting, you know, at least not anybody that I know, that games are just better for teaching these issues. Maybe they're just alternative environments.
Yeah, and I think I actually read the same exact paper you're talking about. And one of the things that I really do think games are excellent in doing is actually sparking that motivation and interest in these different topics. Like at the University of Texas at Dallas, one of the projects that I'm involved with right now is working with the Pro Museum of Nature and Science in order to build educational games for their museum space. Now, one of the things I'm working on specifically is called pollination, which is all about bees and colony collapse disorder. And it's a really simple game to be played within 2 minutes. And so the goal I would actually have with that game is not actually to directly teach this is what bees do, this is what colony collapse does, but actually motivate people to actually learn a little bit more about this topic and actually feel like this is a topic very much worth engaging for them.
See, I really like that approach. I think that that's a really good angle to approach, you know, quote unquote, serious games from, is not as this sort of expository, you know, let's teach the minutiae of all these different topics, but really a sort of engagement and motivating factor for these people. And motivation in games is something that I think a lot of online and social engagement studies have explored this. People like Bartle's Player Types, Nick Yee and the Psychology of MMOs. People like to break down the archetypes of players and what their motivations are for actually playing. And I don't know if enough of that really happens in the, specifically the Games for Change sphere and the direct application of simul games and behavioral modifications and things like that. What would you say?
That kind of depends, I guess, on where I would be looking at in the aspect of serious games. One really good example of all of this, I would think, is the things that I've been able to take from the Meaningful Play conference that both of us actually attended recently. And talking with a lot of the people there, especially the analog game designers, is they always come of this from the approach of fun. So they're always looking at, what are some of these really complex systems that I would like to get people more involved with? And when they're actually building out these systems, they're thinking, not exactly what are the educational goals I have at very first, like what am I going to dispense to my audience? They're thinking, where is actually the fun that I can explore in this system?
Okay. Now, that's interesting. I've got to admit that I'm definitely not as well versed in analog games. Would you say that's a difference between the digital and analog spaces, that analog focuses more on the fun maybe than the digital?
I wouldn't exactly say that, honestly. Mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of the digital work is actually very well versed in fun, and trying to actually explore what are different aspects of fun that we can go through with these different systems. Like in Jesse Schell's work on Elm Street Stories, mm-hmm. even some of the things there, like this game talking about STDs and sexual health for teenagers, seems very serious and very potentially negative in different ways. But what he's noticed is there's different aspects of fun he can even draw out of that, like that it can be even fun to investigate your own social relationships and your own even negative relationships in that way.
Okay. Well, then that leads me to an interesting follow-up, I suppose. I know of several digital games that have sort of an intentionality to be not fun, to be painful or awkward, or to really stimulate you and make you sort of aggressive so that you experience things in a certain way. What are some examples of analog games that actually don't really intend for the player to have fun and instead be aggravated? Do any of those exist?
Let me think about that. Dog Eat Dog actually would be an example of that. It's from the very premise, the situation is set up that you have the occupied group and you have those actually in control. And the very first rule of the game is that the occupied are always inferior to the occupiers. Mm-hmm. And so that creates the very negative perception up front from the very beginning. And oftentimes people might not even have fun with that, thinking that this is always going to be a really tragic scenario that I'm not going to be able to gauge with. And at least playing it from my friends, we actually had a little bit of fun, but it was a very strange sort of fun as we actually explored this topic. And I've actually explored this in my own research, too. One of the things that I developed was a board game on domestic violence issues and unhealthy relationships. And in all the playtests, people mentioned that this game is very, very fun. But also I feel bad in saying that since it's a game about abuse.
Right, yeah.
And so I feel one of the really great things actually with Games for Change, serious games, whatever you want to call this, is this really tests our actual approaches to what fun is and actually lets us see that there are some really unique approaches to fun. Like take a digital example, Cart Life, which
absolutely
takes you through the aspects of poverty and actually throws you in this really complicated, not fun from one perspective simulation, but you can derive a unique form of fun from the play of it that isn't actually based on our own archetype of this is fun.
Sure. Yeah, and that's something that I find really interesting and sort of why I broached this topic is in the digital space, it's pretty common to find games that are about serious issues, but they don't even have any sort of mitigating elements in terms of presenting it in a fun way. You know, I think back all the way to like Darfur is Dying, you know, and I can't remember the name of it, but it's the game in which you bomb a town in Iraq and
September 11th.
Yeah,
September 12th.
September 12th. Yeah, where the more you bomb, the more terrorists pop up, and there's really no way to win. Is that the one that I'm thinking
exactly?
Of? Okay, and so a lot of these spaces really use, I suppose, a negative feedback loop to get the player to get a message across to the player. And I think that's an interesting route to explore because in traditional game design, you know, you have this concept of you want to constantly encourage your player to keep playing or, you know, at least give them some sort of like positive feedback. But in the case of games for change, a lot of what I see is really negative, but it works, you know. And what would you say are some of the differences, or I suppose a better way to say it is, what are the positive applications of negative feedback loops in these game spaces, especially in the analog?
I feel like a lot of these actually help us really explore what fun can be. Like one analog example is the Arkham Horror games, that they're fully built on disempowering the player, creating an incredibly difficult scenario, but that's actually what people are encouraged by. They're really geared towards that difficult negative feedback loops that actively the game prevents them from winning.
Yeah, so you think it's like a sense of accomplishment or sort of overcoming the odds?
Exactly. It's a sense of accomplishment and exploring these really complex topics that makes it fun and exploratory.
All right. Well, that's definitely something that Games for Change brings up that a lot of other fields typically don't explore, is the concept of negative play or really getting into the player's skin. So this has been Richard Wirth and Peter Wanica, and thank you for joining us on Creative Disturbances.
Thank you.